you and I have been, well, I guess we could almost say this is a series now, couldn't we? You were very kind to give us your time in regards to Yom Teruah. We've done that. Just recently, we did also Yom Kippur. And what's next on the list?
Well, just go through the month. So now we have Sukkot.
And so we thought, well, we better do that. And I'm just so happy to have you back on the program so that we can do that. Of course, we're talking about passages in the Tanakh, such as Leviticus 23, verses 33 to 43, Numbers 29, verses 12 to 34, Deuteronomy 16, 13 to 15, and, of course, the prophecy, Zechariah 14, 16 to 19, are just some of the places where this is mentioned. Can I read one of those to kick off?
Yeah. Right. Go ahead.
Let me start with, let's see, let's go with Deuteronomy. I like this. You shall observe the Feast of Sukkot 7 days when you have gathered from your threshing floor and from your wine press. Man, I wish I had a wine press. And you shall rejoice in your feast, and your son and your daughter and your male servant and your female servant and the Levite, and that's you, and the stranger, that's me, and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates. 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to Yehovah your Elohim in the place which Yehovah chooses, because Yehovah your Elohim will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you surely rejoice. That sounds great. I'm liking it.
It does. It does. Actually, there's a strong emphasis here. It says, Vehayita ach sameach, ach. Is to basically emphasizing that, saying that you will surely be happy. And this is actually the one of the things about Sukkot, that it's has extra festivity. People have extra happiness on these days of Sukkot.
It's a real celebration. Practices. And it's a celebration of celebrations.
It is the celebration of celebrations, because it's probably what we can call the grand finale of the cycle festival, starting off with Pesach, the sacrifice itself, all the way through Chag HaMatzot, which we spoke about at the time. Mm-hmm. Then you go through to Shavuot, and everything is building up to this point where everyone gathers in the temple for the celebrations.
Can you give us an idea of what happens this time of year, and also maybe some of the what else happens as far as tradition and customs are concerned for the Jewish people in the land?
I would say, first of all, that this is a very, very busy time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is because there are several things that are done. One is building a sukkah, and it takes time to build one. It's mm-hmm. not something that takes 5 minutes. And the other thing is that we also have what we call the Arba Taminim, the 4 species that we take during Sukkot itself. We can touch on that issue and the different debates on that sure. subject. But it's just a very, very busy time of year, because we have Yom Teruah, so everyone's cooking for Yom Teruah. Then we have Yom HaKippurim, so everyone's cooking towards Yom HaKippurim, and then we stop eating. But then we have, from Yom HaKippurim, literally something like 4 days. It's customary to build the sukkah immediately after Yom HaKippurim. It's over, we sit down, we have our break fast. By the way, the word breakfast basically means to break a fast.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where our strongest is for everyone. You know, every time you do a fast, when you finish it off, you basically have something similar to breakfast. Don't sit down and have like a steak or something. It's not good for your stomach. And we immediately do this because it says, Ilchu Michael Chayil Yiru et Adonai B'Tzion. To go from a chayil to chayil. A chayil is basically a point of strength or a glorious action. So we said, we just finished off with Yom Kippur. Now we're going to run into Sukkot, basically continuing the focus on doing the commandments.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And remember, as a child, and you see this everywhere, even where I live now, is that the moment Yom Kippur is over, you start hearing the banging. People banging nails into things.
Ah, nails into wood,
yeah. People building nails into the wood and everything. And it's I would say, the most beautiful festival there is. And the reason is because you walk around and you see these little huts with green roofs and decorations, mm-hmm. and people being very hospitable. You know, you walk in, you say hello, and everything is a lot more open. It's not, you know, I'm sitting in my house. No, I'm sitting in public areas sometimes. Well, you're technically not supposed to build a sukkah in a public area. But people open, basically build a small house
mm-hmm.
and in areas where everyone walks around, and everything's very colorful. And I think one of the big jokes that every year we have is that sometimes it looks like a Christmas tree. It's so colorful. People literally put the effort of literally hanging the little things all over the place. And I've seen even cases where people were selling like these little flashing lights.
Really? Okay, to put the fairy lights around your sukkah to really decorate it.
Exactly.
Okay.
And but again, when you do that, still you have to bear in mind different rules that have to do with the sukkah. Mm-hmm. So let's start off actually with the word sukkah itself. The word sukkah, when looked at in the Tanakh, appears basically as a non-permanent place of dwelling. Mm-hmm. We have a verse in Isaiah 5 that mentions the word sukkah and the word meluna. Meluna is a very, very small house.
Mm-hmm.
So you see it's something not very permanent. It's not something you really live in.
So it's a temporary dwelling place. We best go into some detail there. What do you reckon?
Yeah, we should go into detail because there's several things you have to understand about the word sukkah.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't only mean a place of dwelling, which is not permanent. The word sukkah is also, the name itself is related to the word schach, sochech, mm-hmm. something that's covering. For example, the wings of the cherubs, it says sochechim mikanfehem, they're covering with their wings, or covering the lid with their ring, with their wings. And really what the sukkah is the roof, not the structure around. Meaning if you had a way, and I know in Yemen they used to do this many years ago when Jews were still living in Yemen, they lived in very simple houses and the roofs were made from basically a combination of different dried pieces of wood together with hay and mud and some type of clay, mm-hmm. and they made a really nice thick ceiling which was strong enough to withhold the rain. Mm-hmm. But this type of roof you have to replace all the time. For example, hay roofs in Europe were replaced every winter. So this is really the time when you start replacing your roof. And what they did is they carved out the roof, and they used to live in small houses. They just carved out the roof,
mm-hmm.
and placed on the ceiling, so the roof, they actually placed beams, and on top of that, they put pieces of, for example, palm leaves or different types of leafy things to actually produce the roof itself. And that's actually what the word schach means. So what I've actually seen in the past as a child, and you don't really see it that much these days, but there was one man I knew when I was growing up that had in his house this ceiling he could open. So he actually can sit in his house and still be sitting in a sukkah. So you see from this, the whole idea of a sukkah is basically the roof, not building a wooden structure around you, not even living in a tent. And to clarify something, first of all, the word, you want to say something?
Well, I just want to clarify what you're saying before we move on. If I could roll back the roof, that would be a sukkah. Is that what you're telling me?
If you roll out back the roof and you place leafy
over the top,
leafy pieces of wood on the top, that would be considered to be a sukkah on a technical level. Uh-huh. I want to clarify a few other things about this.
Sure.
But on a technical level, the sukkah is basically the schach. The schach, the word sochech, is the cover of the roof itself. That's the definition of a sukkah. Now, the issue of a tent, the problem with a tent, first of all, a tent is not necessarily a non-permanent place of dwelling. Bedouins, until this very day, still many of them still live in tents.
Mm-hmm.
So the word ohel, tent, ohel mu'ed, tent of meeting, is actually a permanent structure.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be a permanent structure.
Can be, yeah.
But the whole idea is that you can move this permanent structure from place to place. But the sukkah is something that travelers would use when they don't have a tent. So they'll build a stone structure, a very, very quick stone structure,
uh-huh.
and make a roof. Now, building a roof from stone it requires you to be a bit of an engineer and be able to set the rocks with the right pressure to make sure that it doesn't collapse on uh-huh. you. But to build just a simple stone structure and then get a hold of wood to make as a roof,
uh-huh.
that actually is considered to be a sukkah. And one of the interesting things is that they found in the Sinai Desert, a lot of these stone structures that have no roof, and when you look at the roof, it's collapsed in,
uh-huh.
and it's basically pieces of wood and palm leaves and whatever people were able to find in the area, usually it's palm leaves, because that's the most common tree in the desert.
Most common one there. And so what you're describing to me sounds like the ancient understanding of a sukkah is something a little bit more substantial than just a tent, and the structure of it, specifically the way that the roof is structured, defines it as a sukkah. So I'm understanding you?
Yeah, you understand me correctly. The sukkah, the definition of the sukkah has to do with the roof,
and what is
not with the structure around you.
Now, you mentioned there are, I mean, obviously the palm branches is probably the most popular branches to be able to get hold of. There's other things like olive. I know. What are some of the other ones that are traditionally used?
So palm trees are the ones that are traditionally used, but this is all connected also to another debate that exists. I'll talk about that in a moment.
Okay.
But what I wanted to mention as well about the issue of the sukkah is something a bit different, or something else, I would say. That though a sukkah is defined by the roof, we also see that the sukkah is a celebration of the harvest. We just finished harvesting everything. Now, what's very interesting here in Israel is that you start off with the barley, and by the time you reach Sukkot, you more or less finish picking every possible plant here in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So basically through the summer all the way to the beginning of autumn, you picked everything. So what the Torah is describing is it's called Chag HaAsif, the harvest festival, where you actually go and you arrive in Jerusalem and you thank God for everything that you've received. So what you also see here is that the whole idea of practicing Sukkot is also somewhat leaving your house into the open and then decorating your sukkah with everything that you might find that you harvest at the time. And that actually brings us into the issue of the debate, exactly what do you build the sukkah from?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I won't be surprised if a lot of people here have already read this in the past, but what does exist is a passage in the book of Nehemiah. And the book of Nehemiah says something very, very simple. They discovered on the seventh month that there's a passage in the Torah, in the law of Moses, that says that there's a festival on the seventh month called Sukkot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the passage itself, in Leviticus 23, there's a technical problem. The technical problem is that you have a passage that speaks about Sukkot, then two verses that kind of stop in the middle and sort speak again of, and these are the festivals, the appointed times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then it goes back, and then it says, but on the first day you will take, and then it says, palm leaf, a glorious fruit, palm leaf, a thick leafy plant, and the willows. If you be willing to read that specific passage, if you have it in front of you.
Yep, okay. So
just people can hear it.
That is from we're in Leviticus 23. So on the 15th day of the seventh month, this is from verse 39, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of Jehovah for 7 days, and on the first day there shall be a Sabbath rest, and the eighth day a Sabbath rest. And you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook. And you shall rejoice before Jehovah your Elohim for 7 days.
So the problem here is that because we have the section talks about Sukkot, the first part time it's mentioned, and then an intermission in the middle mentioning these are the festivals, and then goes back to something to do with Sukkot, two different opinions develop throughout time. There's the rabbinical opinion that says that you have the Sukkah, and then you have these four species. So when you come to Jerusalem or anywhere in Israel this time of year, you'll see people walking around with a citron, which is an interesting, very fragrant fruit.
Uh-huh.
Palm leaves, closed ones. Hadas, which is basically, I think it's called in English, myrth or something like that.
Myrtle?
Myrtle, maybe that's the name. And willows.
And willows. And when you say closed palm trees, you're talking about the younger green.
Exactly, the one in the middle.
The one in the middle, yeah.
Exactly. And then they do the shakeabout thing. There's a bit of a song. You shake it to the front, you shake it to the back, shake it to the left, shake it to the right. But the whole idea is that there's a whole custom around it.
Uh-huh.
And it just dates back to the time of the Second Temple to such an extent where it describes that one of the Hasmonean kings was doing something against the tradition of everyone, and he was stoned with the citrons. And so we know this is a very, very old custom. On the other hand, we take the passage of Nehemiah. What does it say? He tells them, go unto the mountain, and then he gives a list of five things. Mm-hmm. And from the five things, only three are really what's mentioned in Leviticus, and then two more where it says olive and what we call oil tree, which is basically probably a type of pine.
Okay.
So the Karaites came up and said, okay, from this passage, it's very clear that they understood at that time that what you have in the passage in Leviticus is really telling you what you build the sukkah with. Now, it's very, very interesting as well is that you find echoes, or not even echoes, that actual opinion in even the rabbinical stories. And one of the opinions which appears is that there was a rabbi called Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi mm-hmm. Judah, mm-hmm. and he says that you actually build the sukkah from the four species.
Really? Okay, because I've never heard that. So what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is from these particular types of trees is the timber that you use to build your sukkah, not only just for the roof, to decorate the roof, but the actual timber to make the structure. Is this what you're saying?
Yes, that's what it sounds like.
Mm.
But even the Karaites and even the Samaritans still hold that what really has to do is the roof, not the, what kind of structure you use.
Okay.
But what we see here is that they take some kind of branches and you can use them to balance everything out. You just put several branches on the roof, and then on top of that you put everything else. And this basically developed into a long argument between the Karaite world and the rabbinical world regarding
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm.
But as a Hebrew teacher, I'm going to explain something very, very quickly here. There's a concept in Hebrew which is called the Chazara Mekasheret or Chazara Megasheret. It's basically a repeat to connect something backwards to something else, a repetitive, either a repetitive word or a sentence or an entire phrase that just pulls you back into a different, back into where you were in the beginning, and then you can carry on. So what we have in these verses, these two verses that stop the issue of Sukkot, is basically a repeat. We're repeating something just to keep you focused where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, it's not a break in the middle. It's not really a break. It's actually something pretty normal. And therefore, that would hint, and this is probably how the people of Nehemiah understood this, the times of Ezra and Nehemiah, that this is not telling you that this is some separate commandment, that you take these things and you wave them around and you celebrate in front of God with them, but it's actually what you build the sukkah with. And what's very interesting, if you go into a Samaritan sukkah, well, it's a bit complex. They build their sukkah in the house these days. They make this amazing thing with fruits. They actually take fruits. They say a glorious fruit. They say basically any fruit,
mm-hmm.
any nice looking fruit.
Sure.
Now, specifically about the citron is, according to certain historians, Greek historians, the citron originated in Persia, which means it's not one of the fruits of the land. It was brought over later on, but it's a beautiful, it's an amazing fruit. I mean, mm-hmm. if you've ever seen one up close, it's an amazing fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It grows, it can become enormous. I mean, I've seen people carry around these 2-3 kilo citrons, just one fruit, one big, big, massive
wow.
thing. Sometimes almost as big as a man's arm. And this is what was considered the most glorious fruit of all, because it's just an amazing thing. It goes bright yellow at one point,
uh-huh.
and it's beautiful, and it has an interesting shape to it. But the problem is, this is not native to this area.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Samaritans do, they make these patterns from different types of fruits. Now, this actually does make some kind of sense, because if we're saying that this is a festival of the harvest of the land, when the Torah is telling you to take some glorious fruit, you're going to take something which is important and beautiful, and you decorate your sukkah with it.
Sure.
And there is some kind of a logic. But what's very interesting is, even in the rabbinical traditions, you still see an echo of it. And something that happens a lot. I mean, if you just take different commandments in the Torah, and you look into the different opinions that exist in the Talmud or something a bit earlier than Talmud, you find people still describing things that would be against the actual tradition held by rabbinical Jews today. Mm-hmm. And as I, for example, mentioned in another recording, that you always find this. This always happens. There's always someone trying to like find the simplest meaning of the word. The thing is that when you look also in the description, not only how you build the sukkah, but what you decorate your sukkah with, mm-hmm. they still describe, the Talmud in the Tractate of Sukkot does describe that you decorate your sukkah with plants of the land.
Okay.
You hang.
In other words, native plants of the land of Israel.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Celebrating the whole fact that this is the time of festivity of the land.
Now, this can I ask you a question here? Because I read in, now I'm just trying to remember whether it was Numbers or Leviticus or Deuteronomy. I can't remember which one now, and I'm just quickly looking for it. But it says those who are native born in Israel will build sukkahs. They're required to build sukkahs. But does that mean that those who are not native-born, they're not required to do so?
So native-born is a mistranslation. The word there is ezrach ha'aretz. Ezrach ha'aretz basically means someone who is a citizen, someone who is legitimately sitting in the land.
Uh-huh.
May it be an Israelite or a convert. A convert, the moment the person converts and joins the people of Israel, he is one of the people of Israel. Okay. And he is not to be mistreated. The Torah actually emphasizes several times, over and over again, do not mistreat the stranger. Now, when we say stranger, we don't mean some visitor from some foreign country. What it means, stranger, is actually the convert. So what we see here is that the commandment to live, to dwell in a sukkah, is a commandment only on the citizens of Israel, meaning people who are part of the people of Israel. There's never an opinion that says that if someone who's not from the people of Israel decides to dwell in a sukkah, there's nothing prohibiting them from doing it. It's just to understand, you have to understand that if you're not part of the people of Israel, you're not joined the people of Israel, mm-hmm. what you're doing is symbolic. It's not really, you're not really fulfilling a command.
Sure.
And the same thing about, for example, the Passover. The Passover says only a citizen of the people of Israel is allowed to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be circumcised, they have to be clean, and then they can eat it. And by doing that, they also join the people of Israel. That's the sacrifice that says you actually get to join the people of Israel. And it's actually a very, very important thing. I think, I don't remember if I actually mentioned this, but one of the biggest problems I'm seeing at the moment with good-hearted Hebrew roots people
mm-hmm.
is that they say, I have been grafted into the people of Israel, but they have nothing to do with the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They don't commune with people of Israel. They don't commune with Israelites. They don't get involved in the Israelite world. And saying, okay, we have a community and we're Israelites, everyone in this community cannot claim this unless for at least once or twice in their life, you know, unless the temple is rebuilt and then they're just going to bring them over. But they can't say that they're part of the people of Israel when they're living completely disconnected from the people of Israel.
So if I can clarify that, if someone claims to be quote-unquote grafted in and yet they isolate themselves from Israel, from Israelites, from Jews, whatever it may be, then it's difficult really to understand how it is that they feel that they are grafted in. How would you, in a nutshell, and we're kind of jumping onto another topic here, but now that we've touched on it, how would you, in a nutshell, say that somebody is grafted into Israel? How do they become one with the people?
Basically, I would say it's like in the Book of Ruth. It's linking your destiny with the God of Israel, the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm. And that is manifest in the keeping of his instruction, right?
That's one of it. But the other thing is to be like the people of Israel, to be with the people of Israel. For example, Ruth did not convert and carry on living in Moab. She actually came in and lived with Naomi, and whatever suffering she went through, she also suffered.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if a person, I'm going to take a bit of an extreme example, no one take this personal, but as an extreme example, if someone stands up and says, I've been grafted to the people of Israel, I am one of the Israelites, and the moment they smell danger, they say, I'm not an Israelite, I'm just a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
That's not being grafted in. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that if there's a Holocaust, you are going to be also part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But also in the good times, the moment you do that, also when the people of Israel are redeemed, you're also going to be part of it, in the good and the bad. So for example, if someone stands there and they see anti-Semitism or basically anti-Semitism is also being against the God of Israel, they have to stand up and say, no, it's not enough. Oh, I'm going to secretly practice my religion in the house, and outside I'm going to carry on as if I'm just one of the Gentiles. That is not considered to be grafted in. Mm. And the other part of it would be that you find a Jewish community and you tell them, I believe in the Torah, I believe in the God of Israel, and you join them in the celebrations, and the day of, on Yom Kippur, on Yom Teruah. And that's actually part of the conversion program that everyone has to go through all over the world. And they, after they go, they start learning, and after they do the conversion, they actually have to find a synagogue, a community to be connected to, not just float around. If they don't do a year of communing with a Jewish community, they do not get accepted. They do not undergo the conversion.
So just to read the verses that you've mentioned, this is Ruth chapter 1, verses 16 and on. And this is after Naomi, I think, almost pleaded with the girls three times to leave. And Ruth said, verse 16 and 17, she said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. And your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Yehovah, do to me, and more so, if anything but death parts you and me." And that's pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, you have to join in to the people of Israel, but fully do it. But let's just go back to the issue of Sukkot. So I want to mention a few interesting customs which are practiced until this very day. So besides the issue of waving the lulav, the citron and everything, called the palm tree a lulav, we're not too sure exactly why it's called a lulav. Some people might say it's called a lulav from the issue of the word lev, which means heart. So it's actually the middle leaf. That might be it. I'm not too sure exactly what's the meaning of the word. It's pretty obscure. We shake this around. And this was also done in the temple. Now, in the Talmud, it mentions this going backwards and forwards and backwards, up and down. And then everyone's going to stand up and say, it makes a sign of a cross. You know, one of the things was that the cross meant that basically the symbol of the cross meant the four corners of the world. And that's how it was perceived in the ancient world. So it's kind of strange that Christianity actually took that symbol as the religious symbol, where in the ancient world it had just a completely different meaning. It had nothing to do with the cross of the crucifixion, because, by the way, it was a T. It wasn't a cross that has a little knob that goes up from the top. It actually was shaped like a T.
A capital T at that.
But because of that, in different communities, they started saying, okay, we're not going to do the sign of the cross anymore with the lulav. We're gonna shake it completely differently to make sure it doesn't make a sign that looks like a cross. I want to warn everyone out there, do not run around saying, oh, the Jews are making the sign of the cross. They believe. No. For us, it's just a form that looks like an X or whatever it would be. It's completely meaningless.
But isn't it interesting, though, that even so, Catholicism has influenced the way that it is now that the palm leaves are shaken because of the association that they have given it. But obviously the four corners of the earth, where does that come from? That sort of tradition, is that something that
it's a tradition. I would say it's one of the strange traditions. Again, as I mentioned in the recording about Yom Kippurim, we have these unusual traditions, these things that probably have to do a bit with other religions that affected us. But I would say, if we say that the Torah is not saying you take these four species and shake them around, we have to automatically say, okay, there's something else going on, there's some other strange practice. Okay. In the ancient world, what they used to do is actually shake when they were welcoming someone important, they used to shake little leafy things and stuff like that. For example, it says when the ark was taken up to Jerusalem, they were shaking mena'anim. They basically were shaking different things, including palm leaves and everything.
Sure.
And this is why, for example, Sunday of the Palms here in Jerusalem, you see it every year. The Catholics, and the Greeks, the Rome, the Catholics and the Orthodox, they walk around, they shake these things around. The whole idea is that this was a form of welcoming. This was a form of welcoming, of exalting someone. And that might be it, that the original opinion of the Torah was that you build a sukkah from these four species, and they incorporated some other practice which exists in the ancient world, and throughout time it was forgotten what it originally meant, and by that it developed into the idea that you have to take these four species and shake them around as well. Sure. That might be it. Okay. You never know. Another very interesting practice is going around the podium which we read the Torah from, and the description in the Mishnah is that they used to go around the altar. Now, different opinions, you know, did everyone go around the altar, or the Israelites went from one side and the priests went from the other side, because there's an opinion that says you can't go in between the altar and the actual temple itself. Only priests are allowed to go in there or be in that area. So there's an opinion that says they went back and forth and looked as if people were going in a circle. But we still practice that until this very day in the synagogues during Sukkot. And we actually go around and we say Hoshana. So if anyone hears this, they're going to identify as Hosanna, basically save us. And we have, there's this whole celebration. People walk around. It's pretty nice. It's something pretty amazing when it's done with massive numbers of people.
Yeah.
And if you go, for example, to the Kotel, the Western Wall, you actually see that in massive numbers. It's amazing. It's masses and masses of people.
So it's pronounced Hoshana.
Hoshana. Many times when you see a J, it's usually probably pronounced like a Y. Mm-hmm. The history of that is that these things were originally from German. In Latin, when the Bible was translated to Latin, the letter I represented the Yud, the Y sound in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And when the Germans wrote it, Germans still had the J as a Y sound, as a Y.
Yes. Yeah.
But when German changed a bit, specifically when it was moved, the letter J itself was incorporated into English, then people pronounce it as J. Now, by the way, in Spanish, the J is a H, for example.
Yeah.
But basically, every time you find words with a J, it's supposed to be with a Y. So, for example, my name is Yoel, but people write in English Joel.
Sure.
That's incorrect. You say it with a Y, Yoel.
Yoel, which is why I'm Jono and not Yono.
Well, you're Jono, but you're really Yono. Because your name that's is right. Jonathan, so your name is Yohonatan.
Yohonatan, that's right.
Yohonatan, exactly. But there was one claim someone tried to make, that it's an imitation of the encircling of religious places in that from the pagans, but it's not true, because what you see in the Book of Psalms is that it says, that I would wash my hands in cleanliness and then encircle your altar. So you see that there was such a practice in the Israelite world even before the Second Temple period. Uh-huh. So it wasn't something which was picked up from the Gentiles around us, the pagans.
Sure.
Now, another very interesting practice, and this is going to clarify a question I was asked a few times in the past, is that we actually don't wear phylacteries during Sukkot.
Ah, right. Explain that. Yeah, okay.
Okay. So first of all, phylacteries not worn on Shabbat and festivals. You don't wear them. The reason is the festival itself and the Shabbat itself is a sign, is a symbol. So the whole idea is that the sign there is to remind us that God is that the God of Israel is our God and everything. And basically what happens is that the moment the festivals come in, we stop wearing them, because we have the Sukkot to remind us. And during Chag HaMatzot, we have the unleavened bread. And during the festivals, we have the fact that we cease work. We don't do any work. And we commemorate the day and everything, so we don't wear them. And so there was one case, this person walked up to me and asked me if I was wearing my tefillin. And this lady walks up to me and asked me if I wear them. They specifically wear them all day during Shabbat. And I said, no. During Shabbat, we actually don't wear them. They were very, very surprised. So that's to clarify that. Just to also open up the issue of phylacteries just for a moment, the phylacteries themselves are really some kind of amulet. The Talmud speaks of the issue of wearing amulets, which are very, very similar to the phylacteries. And I actually came up with a theory a while ago, because when you look at the context of the verses there in Exodus and Deuteronomy, it looks as if it's speaking of the entire Torah.
Okay, so that's Deuteronomy chapter 6. Well, let's start from 4 because this is good. Hear, O Israel, Yehovah Eloheinu, Yehovah Echad. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates.
So as you can see there, if you read the context from top, from before that and underneath that, you realize it's actually talking about the entire Torah.
Mm-hmm.
But we would say that symbolically we tie them on our hands and everything just to also do a physical action, you know, mm-hmm. something which is actually in front of us. You see that the whole idea here is to commemorate something, to remember something. So the moment Sukkot comes, arrives, or Pesach, whatever it would be, we stop wearing them. Because we have the understanding that there's actually a very specific purpose here. And this is something we have to understand about the entire Torah. Besides, you know, physical commandments like helping, loving thy neighbor, which can also include many, many things, helping your neighbor when you're walking in the street and you see them carrying a lot of bags to offer help and help them out. When you see, you know, someone's lost item, to pick it up, make sure it's safe, mm-hmm. and advertise that you found it, lost and found. Things like that. So you see that we have the commandments which are to do with keeping society as a unified society, as being kind to one another. But you also have commandments which are to commemorate things. And that's basically the whole idea of Sukkot. We're commemorating the Exodus. Because
mm-hmm.
it says, for the generations should know that I sat the children of Israel in booths.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that when we sit there, we commemorate that we came out of Egypt. The whole idea is we're going to sit in our booth, in our sukkah. We look at all these fruits and all these things decorating our sukkah. And we say, oh, what wonderful bounty we have here.
Mm.
And then we have to say, and the God of Israel gave us this bounty.
Mm.
That we are not doing, this is not something we're receiving by our own right. It's for the love of our father Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for the fact that he chose us. And he took us out of Egypt. And always remember, we were taken out of Egypt to make sure that we receive the promise that Abraham was given, which is to be on the land. The land is the good that God promised Abraham, and is the good that Moses says to Jethro, actually he's called Yeter Choten Moshe, Yeter, the in-law of Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the good, being on the land. So this is actually, this day, these days of Sukkot, are actually a celebration of the gift and the goodness that God gives us by allowing us to sit on the land.
Sure.
And this is why this whole movement of leftists in Israel saying, oh, just give the Arabs land, it doesn't matter, it's only land. No, this is the chosen land of God.
Amen.
God gave this land to the seed of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and specifically through Jacob, because if we say only Abraham's, we can also include the Arabs into it, but they're not in the promise.
Mm.
They have their own land.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own countries. They can just go sit there. But here, this is the land of the God of Israel, and mm. we have to understand that this is a gift.
Yes.
And this is why exile is the biggest curse.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
This is something that has to be understood. So actually, I would say that if people stand to the right of Israel and say, we support Jews, the land, people of Israel, sitting on the land of Israel, they're doing a mighty deed in the eyes of the of God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something that's going to be looked over. I want to also thank anyone out there who's supporting Israel sitting on our land, anyone who's supporting the activity of Israel on every piece of land of Israel.
Mm.
And it's a big, strong, it's a hard struggle. We're fighting against Arab billionaires buying out land. We're dealing with Arab terrorism on the land.
Mm.
But we also have to remember, and I think that everyone out there as well has to make sure to tell the Jews in the land of Israel to also point out and say, you have an end of your bargain that you have to fulfill. You have to fulfill the Torah.
Mm.
Remember the first time I met someone who stood there and said, you're a Jew, you're an Israelite, do what it says, fulfill the Torah. And it really shook me up, the fact that someone who is not Jewish is telling me, you see this, do it. And I remember that. I was in complete shock when it happened, but I actually thanked that person. I said, you keep that saying that to Jews. Just keep on telling Jews to fulfill the Torah. Do it, and you will be blessed. And also, all the people who do this are to be blessed about it, because you're helping Jews focus on what's supposed to be done.
True. And so, I mean, isn't it, I suppose, you mentioned, you know, people wanting to divide up the land, and I guess it's so much on the mind of people of Israel at this time of the year in particular. Can I just ask you, we're going to jump off the topic just briefly, but with everything that's going on with the Palestinians, you know, sending their application to the UN and the pending votes and so on and so forth, what are just some of the thoughts running through your mind at this time?
I would say that what's said in the book of Deuteronomy, that any nations we leave here in the land will be a stumble and a problem for us, is going on. The Arabs are a problem. They are, I would say very simply, murderous. Many of them are murderous people. When I say murderous, it doesn't mean they actually commit murder, but they're very violent, a very violent society. Mm-hmm. When you come as a tourist, all nice and sweet and everything, but when it's not involving money and they're not making any benefit out of it, they become very, very violent towards everyone. And the places that, you know, Arabs that start rioting for no apparent reason, or they start rioting, you know, they do something and Israel retaliates and they say, it's not fair, it's not fair. This is what's going on with the Palestinians. The whole thing is that, first of all, if anyone sat down to listen to Abu Mazen's speech in the UN, it was full of lies, okay? And I have nothing personal against any Arab. It's just the ones which are trying to murder Jews I have an issue with. But I have to say, I sat there and I watched his speech, and I was actually very proud of Bibi Netanyahu. What he said, we're here under the right of the Bible. We don't care what you think. Amen. But we do understand that you're here, so we're not going to ignore that, but what you're trying to do is basically get rid of us. And actually, there's a video on YouTube that just came out of a Palestinian official saying very, very clearly and very, very distinctly, I didn't even need the translation to understand this. I actually listened to the Arabic and knew exactly what he was saying. He was mocking anyone from the West. He was mocking Bibi Netanyahu, and he basically said, creating a Palestinian state is the beginning of the destruction of the state of Israel. And he said very, very clearly and very, very bluntly. So what they don't understand, what the Arabs don't understand, is that it's never going to work for two very simple reasons. The one above is going to say no.
Amen.
And it's going to completely blow up in their face, because that's the second reason. They do not have the ability to create a state. If you know how Arabs behave and how it works, what happened in the Gaza Strip, what happened in Judea and Samaria, and then we're going to have to go in and reclaim everything. So the whole idea is an Arab fantasy. It's never going to happen. The only way to create any kind of state here is by completely getting rid of the state of Israel, and the world is not going to allow it, and obviously the one above is not going to allow it. Amen. But we as Jews have to focus that we have to do what God commanded us. So I've actually, the past couple of weeks, have been writing about this and speaking about this, that it's not enough to say we're a strong nation. That's what people said at the time of the First and Second Temple. You have to realize that if we want to stay here, we have to fulfill our end of the deal. We can't stand saying, oh, we got a strong army. It doesn't work like that. You can have a very, very strong army, but if you look at the book of Amos, he clearly states that even the mighty ones will be full of fear, that we weak-hearted.
Sure.
It doesn't work like that. I want to state something even more bold than this. We do know that God is kind of on our side for some very simple reason. The mere fact the state of Israel survived over 63 years is a miracle by itself. If anyone just picks up a book about the 1948 war, which, by the way, the Arabs started and instigated, they're standing there and they're claiming that we instigated every war here, where everyone, the UN stood and said this very clearly, every war the state of Israel has ever fought was a war of defense. And they're standing saying the Israeli atrocities, and they show pictures of mutilated kids and everything. Okay, let's start showing our pictures of these. Let's show the pictures of families who were murdered by 18 and 17-year-old Arabs who live in a village nearby. That's what we're dealing with. What's happened is that we won these wars just by sheer miracle. It's unbelievable what happened. Now, we get smacked every once in a while, but when there's a real threat on the state of Israel, every war was won.
That's right.
So if anything breaks out here, I hope, I pray to God, the God of Israel, that we'll never have to have another real war, full-fledged war here. But if it does happen, I just hope it'll be the final one and Amen. We're done. Because it's just enough with it.
And that he will step in again. Look, just to bring these two topics together, I just want to, we don't have to go into detail in this particular passage, but I just want to read the prophecy of Zechariah chapter 14, and this is from verse 16 and on, and it just seems so significant to read right now. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem, I'm going to read that again. It shall come to pass that everyone who is left, it doesn't sound like a great deal of people to me, everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King Jehovah of hosts and to keep the feast of Sukkot. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King Jehovah of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plagues with which Jehovah strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the feast of Sukkot. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the feast of Sukkot. And on it goes. That's, again, Zechariah chapter 14, verses 16 to 19. Listen, I've got a couple of questions before we finish on the topic of Sukkot. Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we have some verses that refer to Sukkot as 7 days. We have details relating to Sukkot of 8 days. How are we to understand that?
So it's interesting. It says you celebrate 7 days, and then it says on the 8th day you have an assembly.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make up your mind, is it 7 days or 8 days? So I would say it's one of those ways the Bible expresses itself. It's not a glitch. There's nothing really wrong here. The Samaritans, for example, in their Torah, correct things like that. I'm not too sure if there's any reason to correct this. But we have to say this is very high-level scholarly discussions, which I don't think I can answer in this type of forum.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say this is not a problem. This is not a technical problem with the text. It's just the way the text expresses itself. But it's what it's clarifying is it's really an 8-day celebration, but only 7 days of it you're supposed to see in your sukkah, and the 8th day is just an assembly. The word there is atzeret from the word atzur, to close something or to put something in one place, which basically means an assembly. But why does the text do that? It's a bit of a scholarly discussion. It's not something I can explain on one leg.
Okay, so we would be interested in people's opinions on that, if you care to, for the listeners, care to put that into the comments section. The other question that I have, you mentioned that it's required to dwell in the sukkah for 7 days. Now, define for me dwell in.
Okay, it's a good thing you asked that question. Dwelling basically means you do everything you do in your everyday life inside the sukkah, which means drag your bed into there, drag your table into there. If you have a TV, drag your TV into there. You basically live there. The only thing you can't have in a sukkah, obviously, is a toilet and a shower or anything mm-hmm. of that sort. But basically what it means is you eat, you sleep, you read your books, you watch your TV, you do your computer work, everything inside the sukkah. Cooking by itself is first of all a problem because it's very, very small. So don't try to cook in your sukkah and don't light fire in your sukkah because that can be very, very dangerous. We actually, in Judaism, we have these rules that certain things are not to be brought into the sukkah.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is cooking items.
Sure.
You can have your plates, you can have whatever you serve with, your serving tools. If you don't have serving tools, and you can bring in the pots and the pans and everything.
Oh.
But the whole idea is that it's basically your extended living room.
So you eat in there, but you don't prepare in there. It's not your kitchen, it's your living room. Okay.
Exactly. It's your living room.
And your bedroom.
And your bedroom. So the question is, who has to dwell in the sukkah?
Mm-hmm.
There's a common practice in amongst Orthodox Jews that even women sleep in the sukkah with the rest of the family. It does happen. It is kind of common. I bumped into people who do that. But I would say that in rabbinical law, it says that there is speak to the children of Israel. And they say, children of Israel means only men. There's a problem with that statement for a very, very simple reason, because children of Israel means everyone. Because if you say that, you can exclude women from almost anything in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of doesn't make sense. But mm-hmm. the general rule in Judaism is that women don't sleep in the sukkah, because women don't have to practice anything which is limited in time, excluding the issue of Passover and unleavened bread, and the issue of Shabbat mm-hmm. and Yom Kippur, obviously. So really, there's like a very short list of things that women are excluded from. I would say it's living in the sukkah, which means eating, sleeping, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
They're excluded from wearing phylacteries. They're excluded from wearing tzitzit.
Mm-hmm.
They're excluded from reciting the Shema every day, because it's something you do morning and evening. The list itself is a bit strange. I've always had difficulty with it. And when I researched into this, I still found that the Talmud states that it's actually the opinion of Rabbi Simon that women don't have to wear tzitzit, but it was the opinion of many rabbis that women do have to wear tzitzit. There's when you look at the issue of living in the sukkah, some people say women can live in the sukkah. So you do find these places where women are said you're not supposed to do something, and you do it. And for example, the issue of tefillin, they say, they have a discussion that Michal, the daughter of King Saul, wore tefillin, and they say, oh, because she was a righteous woman, so they had this opinion only a righteous woman can wear. And there's even stories of the daughters of Rashi. Rashi was one of the biggest Jewish commentators on Torah and Talmud, and they say that his daughters used to wear tefillin as well, phylacteries,
mm-hmm.
because they were very scholarly women. So
When it comes down to the words of the Torah, what you're saying is really what it says is the children of Israel, the practice of Judaism is at the very least the head of the house of the father should dwell in the sukkah. But it really, to take the words literally, everybody can.
Exactly. Everyone is actually commanded to do that. And I don't see any reason why not. And there's actually, I was about to say, there's an opinion that says that women can do whatever, women can do everything men do.
Of course.
You know, but they're not supposed to look as if they're commanded. But really was a way of getting around the fact that, you know, the Torah doesn't really say that women are not supposed to do certain things. The only thing that I have not seen amongst Orthodox Jews is women wearing tzitzit. I've met a lot of Messianics, Hebrew roots,
mm-hmm.
Karaites, women wear tzitzit.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the only ones that women don't do.
Okay. All right, now let me ask you this question, because I know it's going to go through the minds of many people. Rain.
What do you do when it rains?
What do you do when it rains? I mean, obviously you bring the TV back inside, but I mean, what do you do when it rains?
Yes. Okay, so...
Because we're talking about an open roof dwelling, right?
It's not an open roof. It's not a real roof. You don't really have a roof over your head.
Mm.
You got some kind of branches, you know, keeping the sun away.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if it rains? So it does occasionally rain here in Israel, and the general rule is that you try to stay in the sukkah until it becomes unbearable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you've got these huge droplets of water falling on you and you can't sleep or you can't sit there, you pack everything up, you go into the sukkah, out of the sukkah, and you wait until it stops.
Sure.
Now, if it's in the middle of the night, the rule is that you go back into your house and you do not have to wake up every once in a while to see if the rain has stopped. You mm-hmm. just sleep into the morning and you stay there until morning comes. Basically, just when dawn comes, when it starts becoming light outside.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's a general rule, for example, someone who becomes very sick sick
yeah.
is excluded from sleeping in the sukkah.
Sure.
They try to sit as much as they can, but when night time comes, they can become very sick mm-hmm. or they are very sick, and it happens because sometimes it's cold.
Yep.
They're excluded from sleeping in the sukkah. And also, if there's a very, very bad smell in the area, suddenly there's a very, very harsh smell, or sewage blew up or something, you can move back into your house if it even helps.
Sure, that's fair enough.
There's descriptions, for example, flies, or if there's suddenly garbage around, you know, something, some river brought over garbage, it was swept onto on the shore, and it's near your sukkah, stuff like that. So there's a rule that if anyone feels uncomfortable sitting in the sukkah, they're excluded. The only thing is the issue of being uncomfortable is very subjective. So when I say uncomfortable, I mean, you know, something everyone will feel uncomfortable with. If you're going to start sitting there going, I don't like sitting here and the wind is bothering me, it's not enough.
Right. Okay.
You know, I've met whiny people like that. I've met people who say, oh, I don't like the winds here. I'm going to go back into the house. Why? Because he actually wants to sit down and watch TV.
Now, does this mean that I have to acquire some carpentry skills?
No, I don't think so. What I would suggest for anyone out there that doesn't have some kind of a structure they can use, a roofless structure they can use, what you just have to do, the simplest way around it, mm-hmm. is you get a few wooden beams.
Mm-hmm. Got those.
And you get them attached to the ground.
Yep.
In a way where they're not going to move. So, if, for example, you get really long beams and you dig nice holes for them and you cover the holes up and it's stable,
mm-hmm.
you do that and then you get some kind of piece of cloth,
mm-hmm.
And you wrap around the beams and you attach them to the beams. And you make sure you leave an opening, obviously.
Sure.
And then you find a way to attach beams on top to put the roof on. And that's the simplest, easiest sukkah in the world.
Beautiful.
I had actually a friend who used to go out to the field and pick different types of plants and weave them somehow and actually make an actual, like a booth, an actual, like, genuine booth that they were, for example, using coffee fields when people had to live in the field and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, okay.
That was pretty amazing.
It's something that people can be creative with too, obviously.
Exactly. Just be as creative as you can. You can also build a frame, and on the frame, in Africa they have houses like that where they take frames, they take like make a square
mm-hmm.
on each end, mm-hmm. and then they, build up something around it. For example, thin wooden plaques, or they actually take plants and attach them somehow to this frame, and they put a roof on top. It's pretty simple. You just have to take time to build it.
Excellent.
What we have in Israel is you can buy these structures that you just attach them with screws and everything and put a roof on top. That's another way. You buy it from a carpenter. They're a bit expensive, but that's the most comfortable thing, because you can have a sukkah up in like an hour.
Sure.